I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world, ever, ever.
L is for Let's Dance.
It is. So let's go straight to a press conference, shall we? Took place on the 17th of March, 1983. This from the newsreel introduction. Claridge's, that most exclusive of hotels in London's West End, at lunchtime today. Times are hard in the record industry, but EMI is celebrating against serious opposition and for very serious money. They have just signed a real superstar. And then Bowie is introduced by a very Claridge's looking bloke with the words, "Ladies and gentlemen, David Bowie."
And then he comes in looking like we hadn't seen him look before.
He looks amazing, doesn't he? He looks so youthful and tanned and blonde.
Yeah, well, there's a good reason for all of that. So in walks David Bowie in a sharp suit and now sporting his famous blonde barnet. He shuffles almost nervously with a chair and says, "Do I sit down here?" Sitting down, he realises the array of microphones on the desk before him obliterate the gaggle of journalists gathered in front of him. And they can't see him either.
That's right.
Doesn't help, does it? So standing up and parking his backside on the aforementioned desk, he says, "No, I don't. I sit here." So he sits down on the desk and looks very comfortable and relaxed and confident.
Definitely. He goes on. "About 2 days ago, EMI phoned me up in Australia and said, would I like to take a 25-hour flight back to come and sit in a room with 75 journalists? Over the last year, I made a couple of movies and have completed an album and single called Let's Dance. And tomorrow, tickets go on sale in the UK and the next few days in Europe for concert performances in London, Birmingham and the rest."
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so the reporter continues, "David Bowie is here to merely announce his new album, his first in 3 years, and his first live shows for 5 years. He remains the most influential pop performer to have emerged in the 70s, and not yet put a foot wrong through constant changes of musical direction and a constant emphasis on style." So all that is inarguable. Also interesting to note that the reporter drops him 5 years and changes into his link. So he sounds to me like he's a bit of a fan.
Definitely. So Bowie's return to the public eye after the amazing Scary Monsters album 1980, and the world is watching. But it's fair to say that no one completely expected the world-dominating album and tour that was being announced here, did they?
No, they didn't know. So Let's Dance, the single, was released 3 days earlier before the actual press conference, and the album's coming out a month later. There is a really interesting interview with Bowie as well, where he explains his move from RCA to EMI, saying that RCA really didn't like his last two albums. Mm. So we've also talked about Low, how they didn't like that, and how they sent him a letter. And he does say there, one of the RCA executives suggested to Bowie that he should rent an apartment in Philadelphia and try and write Young Americans too. So he seems to have been banging his head against a brick wall with the record companies for a while here.
Yeah.
And he was obviously and understandably galled by this. It's also interesting that the interviewer suggests to Bowie that the irony is that the new record, Let's Dance, is not a million miles away from Young Americans, albeit like a New York soul style rather than the Philly style. Mm. And then Bowie says, "Yes, but it's much better when nobody's telling you what to do." So it's great. I mean, he could have just gone over there and he could have gone and rented a flat in Peckham and still written Let's Dance. But he'd been in Australia anyway, and that's why he was so tanned and healthy looking.
That's right.
But he just didn't want to play ball with the record company. And also, you have to think, and this is looming large within all of these notes and research, that there was a financial kind of gain to be had.
Of course there was, yeah. And also, it's Bowie the contrarian, isn't it? Just doing things, whatever he wants to do in the end. That's what it's all about. He was also asked to comment on the figures being bandied about regarding his signing on fee. £10 million? £17 million? absolutely nowhere near accurate, said David.
At that point, the guy interviewing him says, OK, can you give us a more accurate description of how much you're getting? He went, of course I can't. Okay. So you don't even know. I mean, is it well documented now? It has been said 17.5 million, but it might have been more, it might have been less, I don't know. But he obviously wasn't going
to
say.
Of course not. So, to the album itself, Let's Dance. It's the 15th studio album by Bowie, released in April 83, 3 years after Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, co-produced by Chic's Nile Rodgers. And it contains three of his most successful singles. Title track, Let's Dance, made number one in the UK and in the US, various other places too, as well as Modern Love and China Girl, which both reached number two in the UK. China Girl was a new version of the song, of course, which Bowie had co-written with Iggy Pop for The Idiot.
Most certainly, yeah. And it also contains a re-recorded version of the song Cat People for some reason. So Let's Dance was nominated for Album of the Year Grammy Award in 1984, but lost out to Michael Jackson's Thriller. Well, it probably would, yeah. Wouldn't it? And it had sold 10.7 million copies worldwide, making it Bowie's best-selling album. And it's Bowie's 18th official album released since his debut in 1967, if you include the live albums and the covers album Pin-Ups and the collaboration with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1978.
At one point, Bowie described the album as a rediscovery of white English ex-art school student meets black American funk, a refocusing of young Americans. So young Americans is there hovering about in the background, isn't it? Certainly.
Of course it is. Well, I mean, if you think about it, Young Americans gave him his first American number one.
Yeah.
And he did turn his back on it, as we know, with the ensuing albums. But that did give him the fame that he wanted at that time and then didn't want so much once it had arrived.
Yeah.
And he wanted it again, painfully.
Yeah, of course he did. Let's Dance also seen as a stepping stone for the career of the Texan blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan, who plays on it. Critical reviews for Let's Dance as an album have been mixed, although Rolling Stone later described it as the conclusion of arguably the greatest 14-year run in rock history. So the Beatles couldn't even match that run, could they, have almost perfection, because they weren't around for that long for a start.
That's the thing. If ever I do say that, oh yeah, you had the best run of albums of anybody, people immediately go, oh yeah, well what about the Beatles, which is the only band that they can really throw in there. Some might say the Rolling Stones, you know.
But no, it didn't really hold up with the Stones.
I don't think so. No, not personally anyway. But with the Beatles, it's just time. Really, had they given themselves the time, quite possibly. Anyway, it's generally believed that the success of Let's Dance led to Bowie trying to build on his commercial success with the following two albums, which is where we start going off-piste a little bit. Tonight and Never Let Me Down, ironically, both of which I think were pants largely. And so does Bowie, thankfully.
Yeah, yeah.
He described them as his Phil Collins years.
That is a damning
It must have been awful to be Phil Collins, mustn't it? Because, you know, he's a massive, hugely wealthy rock star in this massive stadium band, you know, and you've got the coolest of cool, Bowie, just really...
And almost dissing the whole decade that Phil Collins became a superstar in as well.
Yeah.
So Bowie had planned to use producer Tony Visconti on the album initially, as the two had worked together on Bowie's previous four studio albums. However, he chose Nile Rodgers for the project, a move that came as a surprise to Visconti, who'd set time aside to work on Let's Dance. Visconti called Coco Schwab, who's Bowie's assistant, and she said, well, you might as well know, he's been in the studio for the past 2 weeks with someone else. It's working out well and we won't be needing you. He's very sorry. And the move damaged the two men's relationship, and Visconti didn't work with Bowie again for nearly 20 years. Well, until 2002 and Heathen, of course.
It would hurt that, wouldn't it? Who knows what Tony Visconti would have done with it, but you have to say that ultimately it would appear to have been the right move.
Mm.
So Rodgers later recalled that Bowie approached him to produce his album so that Bowie could have hit singles. That was what Bowie wanted it.
Yeah.
And it is a fair call, you know. Although looking at Visconti as well, he'd had his fair share of big hit singles with T-Rex, hadn't he?
Yeah.
They defined pop music in 1972. So anyway, Rodgers reported that Bowie came into his apartment one day and showed him a photograph of Little Richard in a red suit getting into a bright red Cadillac, saying, Nile, darling, that's what I want my album to sound like. Brilliant. There's a story that photograph was still on Bowie's wall in
is
his flat.
Right? Oh, is that
I
right?
I heard it somewhere.
Oh, I hope so. Bowie's remit from EMI was to release a commercially buoyant album. The album's influences were described as Louis Jordan, Southside Johnny and the Asprey Dukes, Bill Doggett, Earl Bostick and James Brown. All right, mixed bag there.
It is. And again, you know, you look at Southside Johnny and the Asprey Dukes, they play at like Sale Waterside now up the road. And they pretty galling to think that you've influenced one of the biggest selling albums of all time. But
Bowie spent 3 days making demos for the album in New York before cutting the album itself.
Yeah, which was unusual, wasn't it, really? He just usually showed up to the studio with a few ideas.
Yeah,
but anyway, despite this, the album was recorded start to finish, including mixing, in 17 days.
Bad going at all,
good
is it?
Good going.
Stevie Ray Vaughan met Bowie at the 1982 Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. After Vaughan's performance, Bowie was so impressed with the guitarist, he later said, "He completely floored me. I probably hadn't been so gung-ho about a guitar player since seeing Jeff Beck with his band The Tridents."
He was an amazing guitarist, wasn't he? The solos on that record are just jaw-dropping. And of Bowie, Vaughan said, "To tell you the truth, I was not very familiar with David's music when he asked me to play on the sessions," which is the same for a lot of the people who work with him. You know, Carlos Alomar and all those guys weren't aware, were they? Or Mike Garson, if you look at it. David and I talked for a few hours about our Double Troubles music, about funky Texas blues and its roots. I was amazed at how interested he was. At Montreux, he said something about being in touch and then tracked me down in California months and months later.
A few years down the line, Stevie Ray Vaughan described the recording sessions for the album. He says, "David Bowie is really easy to work with. He knows what he's doing in the studio and he doesn't mess around. He comes right in and goes to work. Most of the time, David did the vocals and then I played my parts. A lot of the time, he just wanted me to cut loose. He'd give me his opinion on the stuff he liked and the stuff that needed work. Almost everything was cut in one or two takes. I think there was only one thing that needed three takes." So the same method of working that he employed with like Robert Fripp and all the rest of them. You know, Adrian Belew. It's the same thing, isn't it?
And also even like wanting to go into the studio and just get it done, which started really with his work with the Spiders, didn't
he?
Unusually, Bowie played no instruments on the album. "I don't play a damn thing. This was a singer's album," is what he said. And this is how Bowie later described the title track. "The original demo was totally different from the way that Nile arranged it. Bowie played an early demo of the song for Nile Rodgers on a 12-string guitar with only 6 strings strung on it and said to Nile, 'Nile, darling, I think I have a song which feels like a hit.'"
I wonder if every time he addressed Nile Rodgers, he did say, "Nile, darling."
Well, we know that he used to slip into the Pete and Dud, Derek and Clive character with Brian Eno, didn't he? So maybe that was just his way of talking to being quintessentially English, darling.
Absolutely. Nile then took the chords, which he said felt folksy, and helped craft them into the version used in the final production of the song.
So long time collaborator Carlos Alomar, who had worked with Bowie since the mid-70s and would continue to work with Bowie into the mid-90s, claimed he was offered an embarrassing fee to play on the album and refused to do so.
He also said when working on Bowie's follow-up album, Tonight, that he didn't play on Let's Dance because Bowie only gave him 2 weeks' notice and he was already booked with other work. However, Alomar did play on the accompanying tour.
He most certainly did. So the album was seen as a commercial and critical success by professional critics, though opinions varied on the artistic content. While one reviewer called it Bowie at his best, another felt it pleasantly pointless.
Oh, that's pretty damning.
Ridiculous.
So, you know, the legacy of that album. In 1989, the album was ranked number 83 on Rolling Stone's list of the 100 best albums of the 80s.
In 2013, The Enemy ranked Let's Dance at number 296 in its list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. Although Bowie had charged producer Nile Rodgers for making hits for him, Bowie would later say, at the time, Let's Dance was not mainstream.
Okay, Bowie also said it was virtually a new kind of hybrid, using blues rock guitar against the dance format. There wasn't anything else that really quite sounded like that at the time, so it only seems commercial in hindsight because it sold so many. It was great in its way, but it put me in a real corner in that it messed about with my integrity.
Well, paraphrased
there,
Bob.
Okay.
Yeah, well, this is, again, just that be careful what you wish for. So we've already mentioned with Young Americans that he wanted to make a big soul album and wanted stardom and the money that he desperately needed at that time, ridiculous as it seems. And now he's gone down the same route and it worked and put him into a corner. And we mentioned, you know, the following albums were him running off on a path to try and make more money and get bigger and bigger. And it was, that was his downfall, wasn't it,
for
that period?
He took his eye off the ball, definitely.
He did. Bowie also said of the LP, "It was a good record, but it was only meant as a one-off project. I had every intention of continuing to do some unusual material after that, but the success of the record really forced me, in a way, to continue the beast. It was my own doing, of course, but I felt, after a few years, that I'd gotten stuck."
Yeah. So he really is a victim of his own success. Bowie later said the success of the album caused him to hit a creative low point in his career, which lasted the next few years. You couldn't argue with that, could you?
No, sadly.
He said, "I remember looking out over those waves of people who were coming to hear this record played live and thinking, I wonder how many Velvet Underground albums these people have in their record collections. I suddenly felt very apart from my audience, and it was depressing because I didn't know what they wanted." That must have been a real crossroads for Bowie there.
And he's right. He is right. Because, I mean, you went to Milton Keynes to the Sirius Moonlight tour, and it was just incredible. But I waited down the front through all the bands that I didn't want to see, and then all the knuckleheads came in at the end, and just when Bowie came on and just made it really uncomfortable to be right down the front there. But I have to say, Bob, David if you're listening up there, which you won't be, then...
I wish you was.
then yes. I had all the Velvet Underground albums, and I've still got them. So on to the track listing then, Bobbert.
Okay, side one, all these songs written by Bowie, of course. Modern Love.
China Girl, which is Bowie and Iggy Pop.
Let's Dance.
Without You.
To side two, Ricochet.
Criminal World, written by Peter Godwin, Duncan Brown and Sean Lyons, a cover version.
Cat People, Putting Out Fire, co-written by Bowie with Giorgio Moroder.
And Shake It.
All right, so we come to the first tune, Modern Love. What a way to start.
A great tune, yeah. So the opening track of the album, naturally. Bowie claimed the song was inspired by Little Richard, and it maintains the album's theme of a struggle between God and man. And the line, "Get me to the church on time," is taken from the lyrics of My Fair Lady.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? By the time Modern Love was issued and edited as a single, Bowie's serious Moonlight tour was well underway, and the track had become a popular encore on the tour. It was a great live event, that, wasn't it?
Brilliant.
China Girl next, song written by Bowie and Iggy Pop during the years in Berlin, of course, first appeared on The Idiot in 1977.
Yeah, so the song became more widely known when it was re-recorded by Bowie, big hit. He released it as a second single from the most commercially successful album, Let's Dance, and the UK single release of Bowie's version reached number two for 1 week, the 14th of June 1983, behind Every Breath You Take by The Police. I can't help, I was born with it. But no, it's a decent pop song, isn't it? And I know that you like it. There's nothing wrong with it at all.
I don't like that tune, I'll be honest. I really don't. So Paul Trinker, the author of Bowie's biography Starman, claims the song China Girl was inspired by Iggy's infatuation with Kulin Nguyen, who was a Vietnamese woman.
Yeah.
Nile Rodgers, producer of a song in 1983, explained his view of the meaning. He said, "I figured China Girl was about doing drugs because China is China White, which is heroin, girl is cocaine. I thought it was a song about speedballing. I thought in the drug community in New York, coke is girl, heroin is boy.
So then I proceeded to do this arrangement, which was ultra pop, because I thought that being David Bowie, he would appreciate the irony of doing something so pop about something so taboo. And what was really cool was he said, I love that. Mm. And also, and we will have all seen the footage, won't we, of Nile Rodgers doing the...
Yeah.
Which, obviously, there was no sign of that on the Iggy version.
No, of course not.
He made it up, and such a brilliant motif for that
it
tune,
is,
isn't
it? Yeah, undeniable. And Let's Dance, of course, the title track single, one of Bowie's fastest selling, entering the UK singles chart number 5 on its first week of release, and it stayed top of the charts for 3 weeks. Soon after that, it topped the Billboard Hot 100, becoming Bowie's second and last single after Fame, of course, to reach number 1 in the States. So should we take a look at the sort of a few of the personnel on Let's Dance?
Okie dokie. So this is where we do the Chuckle Brothers thing, isn't it, Bob?
It is, where we throw it
back to me, to you. Okay, so David Bowie, naturally.
Nile Rodgers.
Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Carmine Rojas.
Omar Hakim.
Tony Thompson on drums.
Rob Sabino.
Stan Harrison, one of the sax players.
Robert Aaron.
Steve Elson.
Matt Golian.
Sammy Figueroa.
Frank Sims.
George Sims.
David Spinner.
And Bernard Edwards of Chic, of course, the Nile's old mate.
Plays bass guitar on Without You. And the production team, David Bowie.
Nile Rodgers.
Bob Clearmountain.
And Bob Ludwig. I should mention here, I'm slightly younger than you, Mark, and you had your Bowie epiphany earlier than I did. But, you know, I got into Bowie when I was about 15, so that'd be about 1981. And, of course, there was nothing out there in terms of products, so Scary Monsters had been and gone, and he was doing stuff like, you know, Baal on BBC. There were a few little compilations, and then there was the Queen single, Under Pressure, but nothing really he could get your teeth into. So when he did this press conference at Claridge's in 83, suddenly he's out there, and he's got a new product, and it's shiny and very poppy and big and very commercial. And so it was just like heaven for me. And I remember going to, I was at college in Southport at the time, and I remember going to a record shop on East Bank Street I'd go to like every week, and having, obviously, all the Let's Dance covers were in the window, so I bought it the day it came out and the rest of it. And he had a giant cardboard cutout, sort of life size, of Bowie, you know, in the sort of boxing pose,
right,
in the window. And I said to him, look, when you're done with that, do you think I could have it? And he said, yeah, sure. So I went in, you know, maybe like 3-4 weeks later, and I got this big thing and somehow lugged it home on the bus, and it was in my bedroom for ages. It's probably worth quite a bit of money now, but I just went to the tip in the end. But, you know, my bedroom at that time was just a shrine to Bowie, and it was just so great that Let's Dance was happening while I was so enamoured, you know, of everything he was doing.
What a real shame that you didn't keep that one.
I know.
That is a tragedy. Oh. And, you know, I mean, yes, I went to see Bowie at Wembley doing Station to Station. Mm. I didn't see him on the stage tour, and at that point in time, I was in the fall, yeah, and that kind of was all-consuming, really. And so I never went to see Bowie again until 1983.
Wow, okay.
And Serious Moonlight. So I never saw him in the interim.
Right.
So, yeah, it was a big thing for me. I remember when the whole thing was announced, Claridge's and all that, it was like the next morning, desperate to get tickets. And I also remember seeing at Milton Keynes, Billy Duffy, what's the singer called? Ian Astbury, out of the Cult, coming out of the backstage area. Now, they hadn't played that day, so they were obviously just, they were pop stars and they were famous. But I grew up round the corner from Billy Duffy and I knew him. And so I was half thinking of saying, Billy, remember me, no chance, get me backstage, see David. But obviously I didn't bother.
Oh, there is that great story as well about Milton Keynes, isn't it, where, because the Beat were one of the support bands, weren't they? And Rico, the Jamaican sax player, had no idea who Bowie was, so he didn't even recognise him walking around backstage, and he just thought he was a waiter, and he asked him for a bottle of water.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
L is also for Liftoff with Aisha.
It most certainly is, a British TV show produced by Granada Television for the ITV network, which ran for 144 editions spanning 8 series.
Whoa.
What? Between November 1969 and December 1974. I had no idea that it ran for so long.
Well, there probably is a reason for that. We will get to that later, won't we?
Okay.
So,
mate.
Preceded by the show Discotheque, which had been hosted by Deanne Greaves, The Replacement was originally called Liftoff and was aired in the children's programming schedule, but was seen by many as ITV's junior answer to Top of the Pops on the BBC.
Yeah, I loved it. So Aisha Brough, aka Aisha, had appeared on the earlier Discotheque in March 1969 and was one of the first women of Asian heritage to front a TV series on British TV, initially co-hosting the show with Graham Bonney and later singer Wally White, and he was a folk singer.
Yeah, he was. The series was produced by Muriel Young, who'd also produced Clapperboard, Shang-a-Lang and Get It Together, as well as Mark Boland's Mark programme for ITV Granada. And the premise of Liftoff was to showcase music requested by viewers writing into the series.
Yeah, the requests were interspersed with performances of either new releases or current hits. Generally, only two or three guest acts would appear each week. The majority of the songs were performed by Aisha herself or would be played into the studio and a dance troupe would choreograph the track.
The main dance ensemble were known as The Feet, identical twin sisters Teresa and Leslie Scoble, who were concurrently appearing in the ITV children's drama Time Slip throughout the 1970 run.
Wow, okay. So for one series, a resident band known as The Pattern sang selected tracks each week. Series 5 featured Guy Luckman, Lynn Garner and Chris Marlowe as the resident singers. Later series featured puppets Ollie Beak and Fred Barker as co-hosts. That sounds like Fred Barker was a puppet. He wasn't.
He was a human
Sorry,
being.
Fred. He was definitely a human being.
No offence. During the series run, Aisha contributed a column to the children's magazines Look In and Disco 45. She also teamed up with Roy Wood to record his composition Farewell, which was released as a single and used as a show's theme tune.
Yeah, so Wood's band, Wizard, often appeared on the series and Brough appeared on Top of the Pops backing Wizard on several occasions. When performing with Wizard, Wood often sported a white star with the initial A in the centre of his forehead, while Brough wore the same makeup featuring an R. This led to some media speculation that the two were involved in an unconfirmed relationship, with many reports claiming they were engaged.
Well, when I interviewed Aisha Brough, this is only maybe 3 years ago now.
Was it that long?
We talked about this.
Okay.
And she said, Roy and I were engaged for about a year. We were together for a year and a half. I met him through Liftoff. My husband, so this is Chris Brough, wasn't it? And I were getting divorced. And because he was a record producer, he was the one who said, Roy, I'd like you to produce her. So he produced the record, which was Farewell, of course. And we got to know each other and ended up dating and getting engaged. So there you have it.
All answered. Good work, Bobbitts.
Although the track failed to chart, Aisha performed the song on Top of the Pops, BBC One. Of the 144 episodes made of Liftoff, it's only confirmed that three have have survived in the ITV archives. What a tragedy that is. The show was replaced by a similar format series, Shangalang, hosted by the Bay City Rollers, which in turn was replaced by Get It Together, hosted by Roy North, Linda Fletcher, and later Meg Nicol, all produced by Muriel Young.
Muriel Young was just so important for music at that point in time. Just so absolutely brilliant. And so you, when you interviewed Aisha Brough, she did tell you about the Bowie aspect of it. And we'll get to that in a short while, won't we? So we won't go through the whole list of episodes, but the series one, the 5th of November 1969 to the 28th of January 1970, we're going to go through these just to show you the array of artists that they would have had on there. So the first one, Long John Baldry, Lou Christie, Millie Small, okay? Yeah. So that is kind of all right, kind of on an even keel. Move to the next one, mate.
You get to the next one, you've got the Tremolos, Mike Darbo, Roger Whittaker, Julie Felix, and Black Sabbath. Now that is a Mick Pickety witch too, Dana, Labby Siffrey, Ken Dodd, The New Seekers, The Sweet, and Herman's Hermits.
Eclectic.
That is a mixed bag.
Eclectic doesn't even cover it, does it? And then you've got another one, which is The Sweet, Ken Dodd, so they were big on Ken, The Tremolos, The Move, The Marmalade, New Seekers, Tony Blackburn, Vanity Fair, Cliff Richard, Olivia Newton-John, Gene Pitney, Tony Christie, Charlie Drake, and on. Gilbert O'Sullivan. But he has kind of reached a bit of an identity by this time, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. So we move on now. The next one, Colin Blunstone, The Move, Roy Wood, Gene Pitney, Jack Wild, Bay City Rollers, Peter Noon, The Baron Knights, Slade, and David Bowie.
All right. So that was the absolute changing point in my life, okay, which is more important to me than anybody else. So we will move on to the Bowie timeline
let's do that.
Okay, so the 3rd of November 1969, Bowie lip-syncs Space Oddity on the TV programme Hits a Go-Go, which was broadcast live from Zurich, also features The Nice and Aisha Brough.
Ah, okay. 15th of June now, 1972, Bowie's Coventry show had been cancelled, allowing him and the Spiders to travel to Manchester to record a TV programme appearance.
21st of June, Liftoff with Aisha broadcast. Job done. My future life as a scientist, Bob, gone straight down the chute. And so I do remember, I used to get the bus down the Princess Parkway. I went to St. Greg's School in Ardwick, over near where the Apollo is now.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the school's been knocked down. There is no plaque. Have a look.
Oh,
but anyway, the short and long of it, I used to head off down the parkway. My mum and dad would be working till 6 o'clock. And so I would be passing pretty much my grand's house in Didsbury. Mm. So I'd get off the school bus and go to my grand and spend a couple of hours there until my folks got home. And one of the things I used to do on a regular occasion was run away from my grand, because she would often come out with a bowl while I was watching TV and stick it on my head and have a pair of scissors flailing around trying to get rid of my feather cut.
Really? So she'd want to give you the old bowl cut, the classic?
Oh, man. Ooh. So I had to be on my guard. So it was with great caution that I sat down on that particular occasion and watched Lift Off with Aisha. And I loved it, you know, and I do remember Wally Whiten really well. And I remember Ollie Beak, the owl puppet. And of course, I remember Aisha. But just sitting down there and watching David Bowie on the 21st of June come onto the TV, you know, thinking about watching this little black and white telly at my gran's house. It just absolutely blew my mind. And so I can't even remember if the next day I went in and communicated with anybody, because, you know, I mean, Craig Scanlon, who was later in the fall at the same time as I was, much of it anyway, he ended up being a massive Bowie
fan.
So I can't remember if Craig saw it. I can't remember really chewing the fat with anybody else at school about it. But of course, the story being now that it was a couple of weeks later, he ended up on Top of the Pops. Yeah. And that's when most people saw Bowie for the first time.
Mm.
And that really was the talk of the playground, as the cliche would have it.
Yes.
But definitely. I was already sold. And I do remember watching Top of the Pops when it came on. I thought, it's him again. And I spent the next probably 3 or 4 years watching Top of the Pops, waiting for Bowie to tip up, and he very rarely did, in truth.
Yeah, I'm jealous of that moment. And there's a reason why sadly, that footage has been lost. The oral recording is still available. You can find that in various places, but there is no visual footage of Bowie doing that, which is such a huge loss, isn't it? And a reason for that, which I'll get to in a second. But when I was talking to Aisha, I said, well, you know, what was Bowie like? You know, did you meet him that day? And she did say, well, I wasn't actually there the day he came in, because I think they sort of shot it, you know, in different time frames. And sometimes she'd go outside and do her video segments, you know, just on location somewhere.
Right.
So for whatever reason, the paths didn't cross that day. But she did say, I'd known Bowie since I was 16, although I didn't see him much because he went through a bit of a mad stage when he was down at the nightclubs with Angie, which is a whole sexual and drug thing. And I was still who I was. She was very kind of straight-laced, always, Aisha. How I know Bowie in the first place is because there'd be Mark Bolan, Bowie, Carl Palmer of ELP, and myself, all at the same cafe at the end of Denmark Street. This would be in the 60s, of course. I'd go three times a week, and every major performer in London would go there. David would be in there, and I remember him with fuzzy hair, just trying to get his songs all done. And Mark Boland at the same time sat there writing about fairies. And then, funnily enough, he presented all that stuff to my first husband, Chris Brough, who said he didn't really think he could get into the fairies thing at all. He said, I love Mark and David Bowie. They were some of the nicest people. All these guys were so sweet, and at the beginning of their career, and it was such a lovely sort of period in my life,
right?
You know, so this went on. The reason that a lot of people don't remember Liftoff, apart from the fact it was a regional program, is because these tapes, apart from three, as we've already mentioned, just got wiped by mistake.
Well, it was actually, you could see Liftoff with Aisha right throughout the country, couldn't you?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, yeah. 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 So what happened was, well, we're probably going back maybe 10, 15 years, I believe, that a technician at Granada TV was asked to copy them all digitally. So all the episodes, so they'd be available for a DVD release and the rest of it. And they'd marked the ones that had already been duplicated with an X, okay? Mm. And it was told, right, do the others. And of course, what he did was he duplicated the X ones and wiped the others. So we've got this stack of amazing material, not just from Bowie, of course, from Slade and Black Sabbath and T-Rex and The Move and all that kind of stuff, that is now supposedly lost in time. Although, when I was talking to Aisha, she said, surely there are some collectors out there, somewhere, not necessarily in this country, you know, maybe in Europe or the States, whatever, who've got copies of it somehow. Unlikely, but it is possible.
It's possible. And, you know, I mean, by the very nature of collectors, they very rarely let things go, do they? I mean, if you think about the version of Gene Genie.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, that just sat in somebody's loft, didn't it?
Yeah.
For years and years. And he, one of the cameramen, who was using one of the gimmicks on Top of the Pops at the time, he had to be persuaded to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, and to have the only copy of it is a bit ner, isn't it? But, I mean, yeah, if anybody out there's got it, giz it.
Oh, please.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
L is for the legendary Stardust Cowboy.
Also known as Norman Carl Odam, born on September the 5th, 1947 in Lubbock, Texas. Often described as an eccentric outsider artist, but he also happens to be one of the unheralded pioneers of what became known as psychobilly during the 60s.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, he didn't know it, bless him, but he was going to be very influential. So yeah. Odam was interested in space travel as a child, aren't we all? He later described how he used to look at the moon and tell himself that someday man will go to the moon. And as a teenager, he combined his interests in outer space and the American West to create the name Stardust Cowboy, adding the word legendary because I am a legend in my own time. To fans, he became known as The Ledge.
I love that. So he's 14 years old already. He's creating his own mythology, isn't it? Like Bowie, really, in so many ways.
Yeah.
The fact that the initials of legendary Stardust alluded to LSD, Odom claimed it was coincidental. He also pointed out he adopted the name in 1961 before the drug had become part of popular culture.
I'd give him the benefit of the doubt on that one, for sure. Odom started playing in high school years as a way of impressing girls. Inspired by Chet Atkins, he learned to play the guitar and also taught himself to play the bugle. Arguable. Probably not essential if you want to impress a girl. Anyway, one of his school friends was Joe Ely.
Yeah, he was. What about his early songs? It was a great one, wasn't there?
My underwear froze down to the clothesline.
So he'd serenade people with that. In his own words, I then learned to play the drums, bugle, kazoo, harmonica, buffalo horn, and the rubboard. Now, this is a American variant on the washboard. So he was like, man, you know, the American Derek Guiler, really, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
When I turned 17 in the 11th grade, I entertained before school to 500 people on the patio, on the tennis court, the auditorium steps, the teacher's parking lot, and in the halls and barracks. Boys threw money and candy at me while the girls cried because they treated me that way.
What? So for 7 weeks, I sang in the parking lot of the Music Box, a teenage nightclub, to a crowd of teenagers. One girl would run her fingers through my hair while I looked into her eyes and I sang Last Kiss.
Aww.
It's all good stuff, this. After high school, he went to college and studied electronics. Whilst there, he hit on the idea of writing a wild song that would captivate everybody. This led him to write Paralyzed, which he performed at local talent contests. So Paralyzed ended up on Kenny Everett's World's Worst Record, didn't
yes,
you?
It did.
On Vomit Green Vinyl and all that. And so that's how most people in this country got to know it, certainly of our generation.
Yeah, so here's the story behind that. So we've been inspired by Tiny Tim's appearances on The Tonight Show. So Odom set out for New York in 1968, only to make it as far as a nightclub in Fort Worth in Texas, which is probably just down the road, isn't it?
Yeah.
Two vacuum cleaner salesmen looking to get into the music business put him in a local recording studio where there just happened to be a 21-year-old T-Bone Burnett already in there, having done a session the night before. So Burnett rigged up two microphones, got behind the drum kit and listened to Odom's instructions to play in the same tempo I'm singing in, and the end result was paralysed.
See, again, I didn't know that T-Bone Burnett was involved in that.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
So Odom played dobro and bugle whilst T-Bone Burnett played drums. The track is notable for featuring strange growls, yelps and weird vocal mannerisms with wild acoustic guitar and equally manic drumming. Said Odom, "The only thing I wanted was to write a song that was wilder than anything Elvis had ever done. His music was too slow for me."
Oh, it would be. 500 copies of the single were pressed and released on Odom's own Psycho Suave label. The song gained some popularity around Texas, enough for Mercury Records to pick it up. It then made the Billboard Top 200 in the States, and he made an appearance on NBC TV's Rowan and Martin's Laughing, dressed in his trademark get-up, buckskin jacket, boots and spurs, and a 10-gallon hat.
This is legendary, the performance in itself, isn't it? And it is available on YouTube, I've seen it. It performed Paralyzed and its B-side, Who's Knocking on My Door. During the latter song, the laughing cast began clowning around him. Rather than taking it in good humour, however, Odom got mad and ran off the set. That wasn't part of the act.
You can see that for yourself, can't you? In the 1994 book, The New Book of Rock Lists, authors Dave Marsh and James Bernard named Paralyzed the worst song issued by a major label. Their justification was that the legendary Stardust Cowboy was a one-man band incapable of playing any instrument, singing in tune, or keeping in time, even with himself. That's not stopped other people, has it, Mark? Let's be honest.
Indeed.
Whilst acknowledging that in some country circles, Paralyzed is seen as a camp classic.
But it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, if you look at like the Cramps, for instance, and Psycho Billy has been mentioned.
Yeah.
But there's a whole oeuvre just been built around not just this one song, but it's a pivotal part in it anyway,
Definitely.
Put it that way. So in 1976, Paralyzed ranked 15 in the first ever Festive 50, a list documenting the favourite songs of listeners of the John Peel radio show.
Yeah, so after he'd appeared on Laughin', Odom was invited to appear on other shows, but they were cancelled because of a musician strike that put live TV performances on hold. By the time the strike was over, his 15 minutes of fame had gone. Historian Rob Viner of Texas Tech University considers Odom's musical career a product of desperation and proof that there's nothing to do in Lubbock.
Oh, harsh. Odom has continued recording since Paralyzed, albeit sporadically, and released several albums and singles.
So we get to the Bowie connection here, don't we? So Bowie borrowed the word Stardust for Ziggy Stardust, of course, from the legendary Stardust Cowboy. When Bowie went to America for the first time on a promo tour in January 1971, Mercury Records' Ron Oberman met him at the airport and he gave him the Ledge's three Mercury singles.
Yeah, and this is Bowie. "Back home, I choked on Paralyzed, gasped in awe at Down in the Wrecking Yard and fell all about the floor at I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship," wrote Bowie later. "It was a laugh of love. I could not believe that such a talent was unrecognised. I became a lifelong fan, and Ziggy got a surname."
He did. Bowie covered Odom's I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship on Heathen, so the song was like an LSD-style homage to the old Van Huysen Mercer tune, I Thought About You. As a way of saying thanks for that, Odom recorded a version of Space Oddity. Bowie had seen a note on Odom's website explaining he was struggling for money and it would sure be nice if David Bowie would pay me something for using part of my name in Ziggy Stardust. Ziggy spelt Z-I-G-G-I-E, by the way.
And probably not with any arsy intent
at all.
I mean, he's a sweet character, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Bowie later told Livewire, "When I read on his site that he thought that because I'd borrowed his name that at least I should sing one of his songs, I got guilty and wanted to make amends immediately. So I covered one of his best songs, I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship, although he sings Spacecraft on the record."
Right, okay. In June 2002, Bowie was invited to be the guest editor of Mojo magazine, which allowed him to commission pieces on the lesser-known musicians that he really loved. And he wrote, "Being an editor for just one day is a lovely excuse to clean out the closet. I found all my old legendary Stardust singles in there, all on Mercury, and that got me into a quiet reverie or two. Along with Wildman Fisher and solo Sid Barrett, The Ledge was instrumental in creating, unwittingly, the now current outsider music genre. Mr. Stardust takes the title of world's most influential cult artist in my small world for maybe obvious reasons."
Yeah, I mean, and people often talk about Daniel Johnston, don't they, in the same tones.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's undeniable. So also in 2002, Bowie invited Odom to perform as part of Meltdown, which Bowie was curating that year. Later that year, Bowie's tour made it to San Francisco, where he finally met Odom at the Shoreline Amphitheatre. I love all this bit. So filmmaker Tony Philpott, he said he was there on the night, and he recalled later, "When Davey came walking into the room, he yelled out, 'Ledge, and ran to him and tried to hug him. And Norman was having none of that. He stepped back slightly and David ended up giving him two hands on the arm squeeze as opposed to a full hug.
Awkward. Oh, very awkward. Also in May 2007, The Ledge played at the David Bowie Highline Festival in New York at Bowie's invitation.
He most certainly did. So a documentary of Odam's career entitled Cotton Picking Smash, The Story of the Legendary Stardust Cowboy, was made during the late 1980s. It's still awaiting an official release, which is a real shame, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Can you get it online or anything?
I don't think you can, but I'd love to see that. Certainly, yeah. He currently lives in San Jose, California, and he's still performing regularly. Since the late 90s, he's played with a backing band called the Altamont Boys, which includes Klaus Fluoride of Dead Kennedys in there, guitarist Jay Rosen of the Better Beatles, and drummer Joey Myers.
In May 2010, a college radio station in Mankato, Minnesota, flew in the legendary Stardust Cowboy and his band for a show. The mayor then declared that May 21st was officially Legendary Stardust Cowboy Day in Mankato.
Well, great.
Right.
In late 2011, the legendary Stardust Cowboy released a compilation of his music, a double CD on Cherry Red Records called For Sarah, Raquel and David, an anthology. The first names referring to Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York, Raquel Welsh, actress, and of course Bowie. Still rumours he might finally do a European tour after all these years. So I think he was a big admirer of those three people.
Well, fair play to him. All right, let's have a look at his discography, just the singles then.
Yeah,
so in 1968, Paralyzed, back with Who's Knocking on My Door.
Also that year, I took a trip on a Gemini spaceship, back by Down in the Wrecking Yard.
Again, 1968, Kiss and Run, back with Everything's Getting Bigger But Our Love.
These are, you know, later releases, kind of reissues. Standing in a Trash Can in 89 with My Underwear Froze to the Clothesline on the B-side.
1991, Relaxation, back with I Ride a Tractor.
1992, I Hate CDs, back by Linda.
And then 2017, Twas the Night Before Christmas, which is the flexi disc with the Christmas card. And I've got that I Hate CDs.
Have you?
Yeah. I haven't got the vinyl of it, but I've got the track. And I've got a compilation of your stuff anyway. Which is brilliant. But there you go. We salute you, Ledge.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley and recorded and edited by Howard Knock. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode...
Lodger, The Lower Third, The Laughing Gnome, Leonard, Jerry Leonard,
Lion's Maid advert.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.